Okay, so the rock you see here is Troctolite 76535, and that's going to be the focus of most of this talk today. So prior to the Apollo program, a lot of people believed the moon to be a primordial, undifferentiated relic of the early solar system, and certainly not a body that could have formed an iron core, and which would have led to a core magnetic dynamo. So one of the great surprises then is that when they analyzed these rocks, they found that a lot of them were actually magnetized. And so after that first discovery, a lot of work went into producing this plot you see here, which is the inferred strength of magnetic fields on the moon as a function of time in the past and billions of years ago. And one of the most interesting things about all of these data that there appeared to be a magnetic era at around 3.9 to 3.6 years ago when the fields were about Earth strength or even twice as high. And so we'd like to really understand what caused this magnetic era and if this is a unique spike in the history of the moon or perhaps a continuation of something that had been continuing since accretion. So obviously, to gain some insight into that, it would be nice to have some more data. The other striking thing about this plot is there are no data before about 4.0 billion years ago. So to gain insight into the magnetic era at 3.9, we'd like to expand the paleomagnetic record back in time before 4 billion years ago. Okay, so first I want to make clear, though, what we know and what we do not know about magnetic fields on the moon. It's very clear to us that magnetic fields existed on the moon. We see that from the paleomagnetic record, and we know that from spacecraft observations of crustal remnants, and we know that from observations from surface magnetometers. So it's very clear there were fields on the moon. It's not clear if those fields are from a core dynamo, like on the Earth, or perhaps from impact-related processes. For example, plasmas generated shortly after the impact may form magnetic fields. The dynamo case is more interesting to us because if there's a dynamo, we could more confidently say that the moon had a small liquid iron core, which unfortunately we still don't know for sure 100%, that's amazing to me that we don't know that about the moon. A very fundamental geophysical property of any body is whether or not it has a core. So understanding the temporal history of the magnetic field strength on the moon is one piece of this puzzle. We seek out rocks with very old ages to gain insight into the history of the magnetic field at early times. But we're also starting to realize we can use thermochronology and petrology arguments to address this question. And the reason is because petrology and thermochronology often will tell you the cooling time scale for a rock. And the cooling time scale is important because it will tell you if the fields that were acquired during cooling were long-lived or short-lived. For example, a rock that cools slowly over millions of years will acquire magnetization over millions of years, and that would be less compatible with a transient magnetic field generated from an impact. So with that in mind, we'll turn our attention to a rock that actually has a very well-constrained thermal history, and that's Troctolite 76535. It has a very old age of 4.3, 4.2 billion years ago, as determined by four different chronometers. Importantly, one of these chronometers is an argon system, and we like the argon system because the argon system is sensitive to Curie temperature excursions, and we like to know when the rock was last heated to its Curie temperature because that will tell us when it was last magnetized. This is a plutonic rock. It crystallized very deep, 40 to 50 kilometers deep, according to Stu McCallum, and there's no shock effects in this rock. That's remarkable, and that's perhaps the most important thing because this lack of detectable shock features in this rock rules out any shock remnant magnetization processes. And so that helps us rule out any impact-related magnetization processes. Like I said, its cooling history is well known, and it's well known to be extremely slow. So any remnants that this thing acquired is going to be from long-lived fields, most likely, as we'll explore. It's also old. The older you are, it's a couple hundred million years older than the other rocks that have been studied. It's easier to have a core dynamo at that time because the heat flux at the core mantle boundary is more favorable for core convection. So how do we actually measure the magnetization in this rock? On Earth, you heat up your rocks and thermal demagnetization is kind of the gold standard. But on the moon, that's a destructive procedure, and we're worried about curation on the moon. And the rocks will also alter in the oxygen atmosphere. and that was demonstrated recently in a paper. So our approach is to first perform room temperature non-destructive AF demagnetization of these samples, and then if it's really desirable, we'll thermally demagnetize them. So I'll tell you about room temperature AF demagnetization, alternating field. A rock will typically have some magnetization vector, and we apply an alternating magnetic field, and we remove a small amount of that magnetization vector, as indicated in step one. And then at step two, we'll apply a slightly higher alternating magnetic field and remove more of that remnants. And eventually, ideally, this magnetization vector will be completely removed and decay and trend towards the origin, and we have demagnetized the sample completely. Now, this is a three-dimensional vector here in space. So how do you actually want to visualize that? It's actually convenient to project that vector into two dimensions. So you can look at it on our piece of paper or on the computer screen. So, for example, here we just take a projection of this process in the Y, X plane, and plot little squares for wherever we have demagnetization points. And that tells us a lot about the behavior of the demagnetization. And we'll have all of our data, all of the information we need if we just also project that demagnetization behavior in an orthogonal plane. And then we have our two different projections in two orthogonal planes. It's just a simple way of visualizing a three-dimensional demagnetization process, and we just plot them on one simple graph, and we keep track of which projection we're looking at by filling in the symbols or not. So just visualizing a three-dimensional process in two dimensions. So let's actually look at some of the data for this rock then. So as you demagnetize this rock from 27.6 millitesla up to 72.5 millitesla, you can see that this doesn't actually decay towards the origin at all, like I was telling you earlier. In fact, the remnant starts with a very low value and increases in remnant. So actually, it looks like it's getting more magnetic. So another sample here does very similar thing. It behaves very similarly over the same range of AF fields. Now, what's really interesting, though, is that once you get to a certain point, that magnetization vector makes a U-turn and actually starts heading towards the origin. So it's like there's two components of magnetization in this rock, and the second component apparently is the last one, because that one is the one that's heading towards the origin. Here it is much more clearly in a sample that has a lot less noise. So you can see that one component grows in magnitude, and then it decays towards the origin. So how do you get that? A simple way to visualize this is two magnetization components in the rock. It's common in Earth samples. And if they're approximately antipodal to each other, for example here, and you start to remove, for example, the one on the left, the net remnants will apparently start to grow until you've completely removed the one on the left, and you're left with just the one on the right. And then, after a while, at higher AF fields, you'll start to remove the one on the right, and you'll start to eventually decay down to the origin. So just two approximately antipodal magnetization components. And what's interesting is four of our rocks, our best studied, very carefully studied samples, show these two different components, and they're all 142 to 149 degrees apart, which is remarkably similar and implies that these four samples were both magnetized in the same process to acquire these two components. Okay, so this rock that has two magnetization components is unshocked. So what thermal events can we look at that could have allowed it to be magnetized? So there's a lot of work that has gone into, it's been cut off a little bit, but a lot of work has been put into understanding the thermal history of this rock. So you can see here a plot of temperature versus time, and wherever there's a study that shows its time-temperature history, I put a star. So the first thing, and then on the top here, you have the Curie temperature of the rock. So anytime the rock is cooling below that Curie temperature, it can start to acquire magnetization. And the first thing you can notice about this rock is that it formed as a cumulate. We don't know when exactly, but what we do know is that it underwent prograde metamorphism to around 800 or 900 degrees. Three different independent studies show this, and also many studies show that this rock cooled extremely slowly over tens of millions of years in the lower crust, down to around 400 degrees as determined by the equilibrium composition of camacite and taenite, essentially nickel iron metal. And this whole thing is happening below the Curie temperature. So, and this all was going on at 4.2 billion years ago. So this is one possible region where we can acquire thermal magnetization. Now, what's interesting then is that another person studied this, and they found that this rock shows evidence for very rapid cooling at around 600 degrees. So that's in contradiction with the slow cooling study. And that was not resolved fully until actually 2006, when McCallum also found that this also found evidence that this rock cooled very rapidly at around 500 degrees. And he put the pieces of the puzzle together, and he said, well, what most likely happened is at 4.2, this thing was excavated from very deep and buried then in an ejecta blanket. And during this residence in this ejecta blanket, it cooled much faster over tens of thousands of years. Tens of thousands of years being fast in this case. So these are the two thermal events that are very well constrained by a variety of data, and they make a lot of sense. Now, the next thing you might want to ask about, though, is we know there was a putative late heavy bombardment at 3.9 billion years ago. So was there any evidence for heating at that time? Well, our colleagues at Berkeley Geochronology Center took published argon-argon release data published 30 years ago, and they modeled the diffusion kinetics of argon for this rock. And from those diffusion kinetics, you can model what the argon release spectrum would look like for a variety of different time temperature histories at 3.9 billion years ago. And what you can see here, you can see these curved lines show a variety of temperatures, 800 degrees, 700 degrees, 600, 500, and 1 year nominal heating event. There's no evidence for this rock being at all affected by the late heavy bombardment. So there's no evidence for argon disturbances after 4.2 billion years. Then, finally, there's also fission track data. So the fission track data is very sensitive to low temperature heating events, 200, 300, 400 degrees, and there's no evidence for that system being affected either. So the most likely scenario is that after 4.2 billion years, this thing has been largely unaffected and had a very quiescent near-surface history until discovery by Apollo 17. So you can also, I also have some other arguments that will rule out extremely short heating events on 1,000 time second, 1,000 second time scales, but I don't have time to get into them, or you can ask a question about them if you'd like, or you can talk to me about them later on. So first magnetization that I showed you was plausibly reset by this excavation and slight reheating event and then rapid cooling, and that could lock in our second magnetization component. So, conclusion, it's remarkable that this rock experienced precisely two well-constrained cooling events in its history and has precisely two magnetization components. Here's the key thing, because the cooling time scale for each of these events was much, much longer than you would predict the magnetic fields to exist during an impact. During an impact, the magnetic fields only exist for most 1 day, but these cooling events were thousands to millions of years long. So these magnetization components were likely acquired during the existence of very long-lived fields on the moon. And the inferred strength of these fields are microteslas. And the only way you can really have long-lived microtesla strength fields is from a core dynamo and, by inference, a liquid iron core. And I might add that liquid iron core is much more plausible now, 20 years after the last magnetization studies, because of a variety of evidence, most notably the difference in the lunar spin axis from what you predict for the spin axis to be in a perfect Cassini state. And you can ask about that too. But so there's other evidence for a core, and this is supportive of that. Thank you.
Series of questions?
Yeah.
Back during Apollo and shortly thereafter, you used Tellier-Tellier.
Yes.
And you said you ruled that out because of the high temperature effects.
Well, Lawrence et al., the study I showed you, performed a Tellier-Tellier heating experiment on this rock, and it was severely altered, so it was a very difficult
to
rock.
Okay. But Casey McGuire and Dave Strangway and I published a way of doing
not destroy these samples,